Get your advanced PhD in WOW from Floor and Decor. If you're a pro, you're already an expert in tile, wood, and stone. And with Floor and Decor's job site delivery, their free design services, and pro rewards that actually reward you, your business is set to grow from one client to the next. Floor and Decor isn't just a couple of aisles. It's an entire store designed to help your business boom. It's Floor and Decor.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. A few months after Winston Churchill took office as prime minister, the German military began an 8-month-long bombing campaign on the United Kingdom, which became known as the Blitz. The bombing, which lasted for 57 consecutive days and nights over London, killed 45,000 Britons. What was life like for the people who experienced the Blitz? My guest today zoomed in on this question by looking at the lives of Winston Churchill and his inner circle during this precarious year of the war. His name is Eric Larson, and in his latest book, The Splendid and the Vile, he shows readers how the Blitz could be absolutely terrifying, unexpectedly normal, and strangely beautiful at the same time, and does so by profiling how Churchill, as well as his family members and advisors, handled both the unexpected horrors of war and the predictable pickles of interpersonal drama. We begin our conversation discussing the extent of the Blitz, and then spend the rest of our conversation discussing key members and what Churchill called his sacred circle. We learn how Churchill's wife, Clementine, supported her husband during the Blitz, how his son, Randolph, created trouble with his gambling and affairs, how his teenage daughter, Mary, managed to keep doing typically adolescent activities even while bombs fell on London, and how his advisors contributed to his leadership. These characters offer a great lesson in how life goes on even in the midst of a crisis, and how one can be fearless even in the face of a threat. After the show's over, check out our show notes at aom.is/Larson. All right, Eric Larson, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So you got a new book out, The Splendid and the Vile.
Yes, indeed.
A saga of Churchill, family, and defiance during the Blitz. So there's been a lot of biographies written about Churchill. I think he's like one of the most written about human beings from the 20th century. What were you aiming to accomplish by focusing on the Blitz?
Well, you know, the thing that drew me to the story is not so much Churchill, not so much the Blitz, not so much World War II, but what happened was that I had been living in Seattle, and my wife and I moved to Manhattan. And when we moved to Manhattan, I had this epiphany about the nature of 9/11, right? In Seattle, you know, like millions of people around the world, we watched the Twin Towers collapse in real time. But it was a very different thing when I got to New York. I realized these people had seen the smoke, smelled it, you know, heard sirens, the whole deal. But above all, they had that sense of violation of their personal city, of their home city. And I started thinking, how on earth, if this 9/11 threw us for such a loop, and the city in particular, how did people survive the bombing of London when it was 57 consecutive nights of bombs and then 6 more months of intensifying raids at somewhat longer intervals, but still, you know, very intense bombing attacks? How do you survive that? I started thinking, well, I could get at that by talking about maybe writing a book about a typical London family. And then I thought, wait a minute, why not the quintessential London family, Churchill and his family? You know, his you know, youngest living daughter, Mary, his son-in-law, Randolph, and so forth. And they're, you know, his own advisors. Take a look at exactly how they got through that year, which is what makes this very different than other things that have been done thus far.
And that's one of the things you mentioned in your sources, the source section of your book, is that you purposely went to look for those frivolous stories that often get thrown out, or maybe just mentioned in passing in other Churchill biographies. And I'm glad you did that, because like, I remember reading those things, those little stories in other biographies, and I always thought, I wish they would go, there's more there, and I want them to go there.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not so much that I look for the frivolous stories, but that I look for, I like to think of it more as context is everything, right? And you know, there tends to be with Churchill a tendency toward hagiography, you know, making him seem like he alone won World War II, when of course that's not at all the case. And I wanted to look at just how he went about his days during this period and how his advisors and family did. And necessarily, in terms of context, that means getting into some of the little stories that, you know, like we all have. I mean, even in the midst of the crisis of 9/11, we still had to take our kids to school, and, you know, we had all that. And so Churchill was no different. So I did really try to hunt for those things that would sort of shed light on what life was really like day by day.
So before we get into Churchill and his inner circle during the Blitz, let's talk about the Blitz itself.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that I think you did a really good job with this book is conveying how terrifying, how catastrophic the Blitz was, but also how weirdly normal it became.
Yeah.
So let's give listeners a bird's eye view of the Blitz.
Yeah.
You mentioned 56 nights.
57 consecutive nights of bombing after, well, so again, context. So one of the things that actually I was a little bit surprised at in my own research, I mean, I knew a little bit about the Blitz and the bombing and the Battle of Britain and so forth. What I didn't realize was there was this long, slow ramp up, essentially from when Churchill became prime minister to the point when the first bombers made their first deliberate attack on London. And it was this kind of slow and I think fairly suspenseful accretion of, you know, Hitler doing one thing, Churchill being defiant, one thing leading to another. And only then did the bombers come to London on September 7th, 1940. Until then, Hitler explicitly forbade the Luftwaffe from making any attacks on central London. I mean, deliberate attacks on central London. There had been an accidental attack on August 24th. So there was this long, slow run-up, which I found very, very interesting and very sort of spooky, actually. But then comes the Blitz, September 7th, 1940. The first bombers arrive that afternoon at tea time. It's a beautiful day, warm, in the 90s. People are, you know, the stores are full in Piccadilly, you know, and suddenly these bombers arrive and start dropping incendiary bombs and high explosives on the city of London. It was incredibly, incredibly shocking and terrifying. The bombing continued night after night after night for 57 consecutive nights. As this happened, people did begin to adjust in some very interesting ways. And that's part of the story, you know, is how they began to adjust. And you know, for example, for Mary Churchill, who is my favorite character in the book, she's 17 at the start of the action. She turns 18. You know, life is still full of parties, hanging out with RAF pilots, dances. There's this annual Queen Charlotte's Ball, which is sort of the debutante ball, which that year was held in an underground ballroom. And it goes on anyway. It goes on anyway. You know, bombs are falling as this ball is underway. That's how people did sort of normalize the day.
Yeah, I mean, and business kept going on.
Yep.
And it was just so interesting to see that they managed. Like, what do you think was going on there? Was it Churchill's leadership, his rhetoric, or was it just, that's just human nature? You somehow managed to adjust to even craziness.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's a mix of all things. I mean, 57 consecutive nights of bombing. I mean, what are you going to do? Stay at a high state of terror for 57 straight nights? I mean, you know, people brought their own abilities to adjust to the program, but it didn't hurt that Churchill. I mean, it actually helped immensely that Churchill, as leaders, true leaders should, that Churchill was out there trying to provide solace when he could, trying to show the people at all opportunities how courageous he was in hopes of transferring some of that courage to them. And I think it all went into the mix where people began to normalize their lives. It helped also that the Luftwaffe decided that daytime raids were just too costly. Because the RAF was really pummeling them on daytime raids. Bombers were slow, much slower than the RAF, about Hurricanes and Spitfires. So the Germans abandoned daylight raids, which really helped, because then during the day, people led relatively normal lives. They came to work, they commuted to work, they left early enough to get home before the blackout. They brought their gas masks to work just in case, you know, that kind of thing. So that helped also. If you were pretty certain, relatively certain, or you could be relatively certain that during the day the bombers would not come, that kind of helped level out the day. However, the flip side of that was the equal certainty that they would come that night almost, well, for sure during that first period.
One of the things you did, you went to diaries written during this time. And I thought one of the interesting stories you pull out of that, like lovemaking affairs actually picked up during the Blitz, because people would use the Blitz as an excuse to like, oh, well, I was gone. I was taking cover.
Yeah. I mean, you think about that, you know, I mean, bombs are falling and it's terrifying. And, you know, you got to live your life. And what have you got to lose? You know, so people were having affairs. Seemed to be like everybody was having an affair. You know, there was a lot of sex going on. And that was one of the things that I found kind of delightful too in the research.
So how many Britons ended up being killed during the Blitz?
Okay, so you're taxing my always faulty short-term memory, but I believe by the time the Blitz ended, the 1940-41 period, I think the number killed was 47,000. The number seriously injured was like another 50,000. So,
yeah, and as you talked about the destruction, it was you could have, you know, one block completely just, you know, annihilated,
right?
But the block over, fine.
Well, yeah, because of the inaccurate nature of bombing and the character of some weapons. For example, the Germans, the Luftwaffe, used what were referred to as parachute mines, which were very large, basically explosive pellets that were dropped by parachute into a neighborhood. If one of those landed in your neighborhood, went off, you had no neighborhood. I mean, it would just destroy that complete area. Similarly, the Germans had a bomb, 4,000-pound bomb, 13 feet long, which they named Satan. And if that landed in your neighborhood, you also lost your neighborhood. But then the reality was, you know, two blocks away, you could drive down a street that looked like there had not been a war yet.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the title of the book, The Splendid and the Vile.
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
So Splendid and the Vile comes from a diary entry by a key character in the book, John Colville, who was one of Churchill's private secretaries. He had a number of those, all young men who were very hardworking. And they're really sort of more or less like, almost like assistant prime ministers, really. And John Colville was one of the hardest working, one of the most interesting, because he kept a daily diary. He should not have kept that diary. It was a violation of the National Secrets Act. But he kept a daily diary. And one night, he writes about this in his diary. One night during a particularly severe raid, he was looking out the window, watching this from a bedroom, as one does apparently. And so he's watching this raid, and he is struck by the beauty of the bombs and the searchlights and guns firing and so forth. And he writes this beautiful entry in his diary, which ends with how this was a juxtaposition of he called it natural splendor and human vileness. As soon as I read that entry, I thought, yeah, this is going to be my title, The Splendid and the Vile. And it stayed ever since. I mean, I had to fight for it a little bit, but...
Right. No, I'm glad you fought. It was such a great title, because that really does encapsulate war. And sometimes we forget the Latin word for war, bellum. Like, it's also bella, beautiful.
Ah, okay.
That's weird.
True.
Yeah, it's weird. So let's talk about this inner circle that Churchill used. I mean, he actually referred to it as secret circle. It was sort of his... These are the people that buoyed him up during this time. And we'll talk about John Colville here in a bit, but let's talk about the ones closest to him. And his one that played a big role in this book was his wife, Clementine, who was a character. I mean, I think she doesn't get the attention that she probably deserves.
I think actually they're all characters in this book.
Yeah, they are.
Anyway, but yes.
Well, let's talk about Clementine.
She was a very interesting, compelling woman, yeah.
I mean, what was her role in the Blitz and during this first year?
In this first year, she really did decide what her job was going to be was to support Churchill. That was going to be her job. And, you know, she is sort of threaded through the narrative, not as much as Mary, but she's threaded through the narrative as supporting him. But also, she's a very independent person. She had her own bedroom. And she did not care that much, honestly, for most of Churchill's friends. And she would prefer some of these nights just not to be around, you know, when he had his parties. But she proved very, very interesting in this in a couple of ways. For one, there was a point where Churchill, in her view, was starting to become even more inconsiderate than usual. He had a real inconsiderate, rude side, and his employees were starting to chafe at this. And Clementine writes him this letter where she says, you know, you are not as nice as you used to be, and advises him on how he should be behaving and so forth, which is very good, sort of a nice nice break on him getting completely off the planet with his irascibility and so forth. But there's also a point where she goes and visits all the shelters, not all the shelters, but a number of public shelters, which were a mess. And she just ventures in. Clementine Churchill ventures in and captures Dickensian detail about how awful these places were. And that was very cool.
And she was a big part of the reforms that happened in the shelters.
Yes. She was a big part of advising Churchill on the reforms, and he accepted that her views. Yes.
And so, you know, some of the things they talked about, they just wanted people to be comfortable, so they made sure they got their tea.
Well, the tea was an interesting thing. Yeah, I mean, tea runs through the whole book also, because tea was everything. Tea was England. But one of the characters, Frederick Lindemann, Churchill's science advisor, you know, ordinarily a cold fish, but in one memorandum to Churchill, he tried to get the government to reconsider a decrease in the amount of tea available under the rationing program. And it was a very interesting memorandum, because he makes the point that tea was crucial to the underclasses in terms of their only luxury, and how important it was to maintain at least that. And so that was kind of a very warm-hearted, interesting memorandum.
So you talk about one of the goals of your book is to explore what family life was like during the Blitz. And so besides managing a country during a siege, there was family drama going on with the Churchills, and a big source of that drama was his son Randolph.
Yeah,
tell us about Randolph Churchill.
Yeah, so Randolph Churchill was kind of I guess the term would be a wastrel. I mean, he was a very bright guy, very handsome guy, but he was a very heavy drinker, and he was a spendthrift and an inept gambler. He lost a lot of money, and he was married to a young woman, Pamela Digby. She took his name, so it's Pamela Digby Churchill. And their relationship was, you know, fine at first. When the action begins, they'd been only married for about a year. And, you know, she loved him. He may or may not have loved her. I think he did. But he also was a philanderer. On the day that she gives birth to their child, Winston Jr., he is in bed with somebody else's wife. But he was a really difficult character. He was really sort of outrageously outspoken, annoying, difficult character.
Well, I think Churchill once said that he loves Randolph, just doesn't like him.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And I mean, he was dealing this throughout the war. There'd be something, well, Randolph's got these gambling debts, and Pamela had, it's sort of the point where Pamela stopped telling the Churchills about the gambling debts that Randolph was accruing.
So yeah, I mean, at one point the debts were accumulating to the point where, you know, they were really in hard straits. They got a bailout at one point from Churchill, but he said, you know, this better be the end of it. And that was not the end of it. So there's one moment where Pamela's in Harrods, the famous department store, and, you know, her credit, line of credit with the store was suddenly withdrawn because of excess debts by Randolph. And this was a tremendous humiliation. She flees the store in tears. And their marriage through the book begins to wobble and degrade and eventually to explode.
Well, we'll talk about the explosion here in a bit, because it was an interesting dynamic between the Churchills and Pamela. But let's go back to John Colville. So this is a personal secretary. He was keeping diaries during the whole entire time. He didn't have to. He wasn't supposed to do that. What was so captivating about his story? What do you think his story tells about that you were trying to convey?
Well, the most important thing about John Colville is that his diary, well, there's a number of things about John Colville, but really his diary was the best insight into the daily functioning of 10 Downing Street during this 1940-41 period. He should not have been keeping the diary. It was essentially illegal. It was a violation of national security laws, but he kept it anyway. But the thing I felt about John Colville, I mean, I'm obviously not the first person to use that diary, not the first to refer to him. He makes a cameo, I believe, in the TV series The Crown. But I felt that John Colville really needed to be, sort of wanted to step forward and become a more full-bodied character in a work of history about Churchill. Nobody has done that really until now. And so to me, you know, I wanted to know more about what his life was like. You know, it's one thing to be a secretary, private secretary in Churchill's office, but what else was going on? So at one point, I went in to take a look at his diary in the actual diary at the Churchill Archive Center in Cambridge. There's the published version, The Fringes of Power, which is very good, very accurate, very true to the original diary. But in that, he made a reference to the fact that the things he cut out were he cut out trivialities. So I was interested in those trivialities. So I set about trying to find out, well, what did he cut? It's very evident when you go through the two diaries, but I don't think anybody else has bothered to do that, honestly. And I found that the things he cut out were certainly not trivialities at the time. He was in love. He was in love. And this is what sort of defined his emotional concerns in those days. He was in love with this young woman, Gay Margeson, and obsessed with her, really. And she was not returning the favor. So this runs through the book as well. And you know, again, context to me is everything.
Yeah, it's one of those, again, it shows how life went on. Exactly. And what I also liked about Colville is at the beginning, when he started working with Churchill, he wasn't really sure about him. But then as his relationship with Churchill progresses, he starts to deeply admire him.
Yes. And it's important to know that Colville, prior to this, he was a private secretary for Neville Chamberlain. And Neville Chamberlain was a very different kind of guy. Neville Chamberlain was sort of a more austere character. His nickname was the Coroner, or the Old Umbrella. And then suddenly this dynamo Churchill comes in, and Colville ends up working for him. And Colville really liked and was loyal to Chamberlain. And he was like, oh, yeah, he felt this was going to be a difficult thing to have Churchill there as prime minister. But over time, he came to see the thing that the world eventually came to see, which is that Churchill was quite a brilliant leader in this period. He was the man for the hour. I mean, you can criticize Churchill for a lot of things, his early 20th century sort of depredations as a classic imperialist, in Africa and so forth, and his post-World War II actions in Kenya and India and so forth. But in this period, he was the man of the hour, and Colville came to recognize that.
How did Churchill rely on Colville? Were you able to see that he leaned on Colville at all?
He leaned on all of his private secretaries, because believe me, without them, he could not have done what he did. These guys worked their tails off.
Yeah, give him an idea. Like, they were working from 6 o'clock, sometimes till 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning.
They worked until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, And whoever was on duty was the point man for all this. And they were, helping him gather memoranda, helping him, his other secretaries took dictation for speeches and so forth, but Colville and the others were responsible for putting this stuff in shape, for getting things published in the appropriate places, for talking to other ministers. It was these poor guys just they had no lives. But and again, Churchill could be incredibly rude. He could be, overbearing. He could be very, very much boorish. But he had this other side to him that was so very warm and fun. And that's, no matter how hard these guys worked, they loved him. And they would not have traded that whole period for anything.
That was an interesting thing. So Churchill never apologized. He never said, I'm sorry, but he would do things after a blow up that would convey, I'm sorry, we're still good.
He never apologized, but he somehow managed to communicate through whatever signal of the moment seemed appropriate that all was forgiven. Like Beaverbrook says at one point that when this happened with Churchill, that he might then, after the initial anger had subsided, he might then in a moment put his hand on Beaverbrook's wrist, just gently, and that was the signal that all is good. It's a momentary blow up. It's over.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million bucks, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code manliness to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code manliness. Check it out today. If you're like me, you've probably signed up for subscription services, but then you forgot about them. I'm talking about newsletters, streaming services, things like that. Well, with the personal finance app Rocket Money, it can help you find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions. It can also monitor your spending and help you lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. I had a chance to use Rocket Money, connected it to my checking account, and it found a bunch of subscription services that I forgot about. I was able to cancel them, and I was able to save a lot of money because the stuff adds up. Besides canceling your unwanted subscriptions, Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lower bills for you, up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/manliness. That's rocketmoney.com/manliness. rocketmoney.com/manliness. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast, and right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, M-A-N-L-I-N-E-S-S. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, picture that thing you've always wanted to learn. Now picture learning it from the person who's literally the best at it in the world. That's what you get with Masterclass. This year, learn from the best to become your best with Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. So for example, you can learn the art of negotiation from Chris Voss, we had him on the podcast, leadership from Jocko Willink, another AOM podcast guest, writing from Malcolm Gladwell, another AOM podcast guest. You name it, Masterclass has it. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. So I did the masterclass with Chris Voss on negotiation. Very well done. He talks about tactical empathy, how to mirror somebody so that you can develop rapport with them. So if you enjoyed that podcast I did with Chris Voss several years ago about his book, Never Split the Difference, you're going to love this masterclass. And right now, AOM listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. masterclass.com/AOM. Check out the negotiation class with Chris Voss. And now back to the show.
Well, let's talk about Lord Beaverbrook, because this is another character. What was his role during this first year?
Beaverbrook's role during this first year was really very important. Now, Beaverbrook and Churchill had been friends off and on throughout the years, but mostly friends. And now at this point, we're friends again. And as soon as Churchill becomes prime minister on May 10, 1940, he makes Beaverbrook his Minister of Aircraft Production. Very important job. Beaverbrook is at this point, he's a newspaper magnate. He publishes newspapers. He doesn't really know much about manufacturing, hard things. But Churchill recognizes in him the kind of galvanizing energy that is going to be necessary to step up production of fighter aircraft, which Churchill rightly recognized from the get-go was going to be the crucial ingredient in trying to hold off any effort to invade England by Hitler. And that, that threat of invasion at this time was a very concrete thing. There were concerns that, you know, Hitler, the German Air Force and Army could invade the next day, you know, on any given day. That one day you'd be sitting there in Hyde Park and you know, 100 paratroopers would descend, you know, around the Serpentine in the park. You know, it was a very real possibility. But Churchill recognized that the way to stop that, the way to deny the Luftwaffe air superiority, which is what they would have needed if they were going to try to invade, if the Germans were to try to invade England, he recognized that fighters were the only way to do that. Did not have enough fighters. Appoints Beaverbrook, Minister of Aircraft Production. Beaverbrook works what amounts to sort of an act of magic over time, radically steps up production of Spitfires and Hurricanes. Not as radically as he would like to think, but he radically stepped up production and really sort of saved the day. At the same time, he was an irascible, potentially cantankerous, cataclysmically energetic guy, demanding, peevish, toddlerish. In the course of 1940-41, he resigns 14 times, mainly to get attention from Churchill. And but Churchill knew him. He knew his man. He knew that Max, and Max was his real name. Lord Beaverbrook was, you know, styled Lord Beaverbrook. Max Aitken was his real name. He knew that Max was going to be a problem. He knew he was going to be a problem. But that's what he wanted. He wanted him to be a problem. He wanted him to sow conflict because he wanted aircraft production juiced up as much as possible.
And he gossiped like a church lady.
He what?
He's a gossip. Like, he loved to gossip about what was going on. He loved to have
Beaverbrook
dirt on people.
Loved, as I talk about in the book, he loved to collect secrets. He loved to collect other people's secrets. He liked knowing the things that were in people's closets and then manipulating those people if he could. He was a real talent in that respect. And that didn't hurt either, you know, in terms of, well, I mean, it hurt some people, but it didn't hurt in terms of getting things done.
Well, this happened, like Pamela, Randolph's wife, eventually went to Beaverbrook for the debt problem that she was having.
Well, yeah. I mean, when Pamela realized that the debts that she thought had been paid off by Churchill, but that there was actually were actually not fully paid off because there were other debts in the pipeline, which is horrifying to her. She went to Beaverbrook and told him the story and wanted to get help with the debt, and in the process sort of put herself into the sway of his world in a very interesting way. And in the end, you know, he did help her, but, you know, sort of the devil's bargain.
Right. Randolph even told her, don't ever go to Beaverbrook.
Randolph had told her before, don't ever let yourself get under Beaverbrook's control.
And I think to give some context too, some of the things that surprised me, because whenever I imagine, you know, people from a long time ago, I always imagined they're like in their 30s or their 40s. Pamela was only 21 when this was going on. So I couldn't imagine being 21 years old, new baby, and you've got hundreds, I mean, what today would amount to hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt.
Right. Yeah, she seemed much older than her years. She was 21, but she was a very flirtatious, very easy way with people and sexually knowing person, very much sort of, I would say, coveted by men, and knew what she had and was very willing to use that to help her get away. So she was a very dynamic character. And when their marriage began to fail, which it did quite spectacularly, and once she recognized that she was on her own, she really took very concerted steps to just carve her own way.
And one of the ways she did that, one of the people that entered into the Churchill secret circle was an American, Harriman.
Yes, Avril Harriman.
What was his story? What was his role there?
Avril Harriman was a businessman from America. He was actually the founder of Sun Valley, the resort in Idaho, mainly to founded that to try to get increased rail travel for his family railroad in the wintertime. Harriman was an immensely attractive man. Tall, very handsome, very, very athletic. He was sent by Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, Franklin D. Roosevelt, to London to administer the so-called Lend-Lease program after it had finally been passed, which was a long saga in itself. Nominally, his mission was to was to determine who got what aid and how they got it and what was done with it and so forth. But really, he was sent by Roosevelt to kind of report on what was really happening with Churchill and with the war, and to send back reports about what was really, really happening. But it turns out that, yes, he had that mission, but then Churchill, recognizing that he was Roosevelt's emissary, he said about really bringing him into his inner circle, like so almost like the courtship of a woman, brought him into his innermost circle to try to, you know, to try to by proxy win Roosevelt's intervention ultimately in the war. He hoped that Roosevelt would intervene, and of course Pearl Harbor comes along and he does. But Harriman also was a very, very attractive guy. And at one party he meets Pamela Churchill, who at this point is convinced that has decided her marriage is done. And they, during an air raid, they go down to his apartment, which is deemed to be safer. It's in this hotel called the Dorchester. And one thing leads to another and dot, dot, dot.
And did the Churchills know about it, the affair?
Yeah, I believe the Churchills did know about it, not immediately, but they did know about it. I don't think anybody really seriously doubts that they did, but they did not make a big thing about the affair. When later Randolph got really annoyed when he found out about the affair, that his parents had been sort of, you know, wittingly supporting a cuckold cuckolding him in the Churchill family. So
do you think do you think anything to what Randolph accused him? Like, did Churchill kind of use Pamela as a political, you know, connection? Or
I'm sure he did once he realized that. He was very, very good at this courtship of America. I mean, it's like an ace fly fisherman, using every single technique he could to just sort of reel Roosevelt closer and closer and closer. And when he found out, and I have no doubt that he found out that Pamela and Harriman were having an affair, I'm sure he was delighted. You know, this is like all in the family, you know, especially now.
Well, I think Churchill was used to that sort of thing. I mean, his mother was, how would you say, she did that, she was unfaithful. She was known as courtesan, I mean, basically.
Yeah, well, basically in this town, everybody was unfaithful. I mean, that's one of the things that comes through in my work. Actually, it almost doesn't matter what era I'm looking at. There's a lot more sex going on than you would ever imagine.
Right. And so the sort of the happy ending with that, I mean, if you can call it a happy, I mean, it's kind of a happy ending with Pamela and Harriman. They eventually, they go their separate ways. They stay married to their respective spouses. Yeah. But then...
Well, she eventually divorces Randolph.
Yeah, she divorces Randolph.
Fairly early on.
But decades later, yeah, they end up getting married.
Yeah. Well, that's true. It's very sort of... It's kind of a romantic story. Romantic also in the sense that Harriman did stay with his wife, despite the revelation of this affair. And they actually grew closer and closer over the years. And when his wife died, you know, decades after the war, Harriman was absolutely crushed. And at one point, though, he is invited to a party at Catherine Graham's house, the owner of the Washington Post, reconnects with Pamela, and the next thing you know, they're married. This long saga has, you know, come full circle, and they're husband and wife.
So you mentioned Mary.
Yeah.
Mary Churchill was your favorite character. Why was she your favorite character?
Mary was my favorite character because, well, first of all, she's brand new in terms of Churchill scholarship. When I was granted, thankfully, permission to look at her diary by her daughter, I was one of two scholars who had been given that opportunity. I don't know who the other scholar was, but Mary has not been, you know, heavily written about in any work on Churchill until now. And what I really liked about her was that, you know, she was, again, context, she was this very charming, smart, pretty, very intelligent 17-year-old whose life followed a very interesting arc in this time. She was a very compelling counterpoint to what was going on in the world. Like, she loved her father, and she commented on the action day by day in his daily diary. And it was really a wonderful insight, not just into what was actually happening on the broader world stage, but also what was happening in her life, the context, snogging in the hayloft with the RAF pilots, you know, that kind of thing. And the RAF pilots, at a nearby base, bomber pilots. You know, these are young guys in their 20s, you know, 19, 20, 21, 22. They knew Mary was at Chequers, the prime minister, real estate in the country outside London. They knew Mary was there. They knew her friends were there, and they would engage in a process that she refers to repeatedly in her diary as beating up, which is when the bombers would fly over at treetop level and just buzz the girls. They were thrilled. They loved this.
And I mean, as you read her diaries, life went on for her too. She got proposed to, and she had to, you'd see the agony of like whether to accept or not, and the tension between her and her mother about whether to accept or not.
No, I mean, this, so I mean, she follows a very interesting arc through a book. I mean, I don't want to necessarily give away exactly what happens, but suffice it to say that, you know, one reason, see, this book takes place in that first year of his prime ministership, premiership, May 10, 1940 to May 10, 1941. But it was not that year per se that drew me. This is not a book about the first year of the prime minister. This is a book that I did because the action happens to match conveniently that first year. On May 10, 1941, three different narrative threads all converge and end on that day, which almost never happens in the world of, you know, historical writing. And one of those was her particular saga.
Right. And what I find interesting about Mary, when I've read about her, it seems like out of all the Churchill children, she was the most well-adjusted. She didn't have like the personal drama like a Randolph or even her older, I think she had an older sister as well.
Yes, she had two sisters, Diana and Sarah.
What do you think went on there? Like, why did the other Churchill's children kind of end up, have all these personal problems and Mary didn't?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I didn't spend a lot of time, obviously, thinking about looking into the other sisters. I wanted to focus on a few important characters. But, you know, I mean, three, four, five times the charm. I mean, you know, she was the youngest and was doted upon by her parents. And I don't know, maybe that's part of it.
So you mentioned Chequers. That was the prime minister estate out in the country outside of London. And that seemed to play a pivotal role. And that's where Churchill would convene his inner circle.
Yes.
And not only, they continued to work there, but they also blew off steam there. What were some of the stories, a few of your favorite stories from Chequers that you really showed, that really conveyed that inner circle?
So Chequers really did become kind of a character in the book. I was fascinated by Chequers, fascinated by how Churchill used it. Chequers was this lovely old house on some sprawling grounds outside London that had been donated to the government by a very generous guy. And the rule for the house was supposed to be that prime ministers were not supposed to do any work there. It's supposed to be a place where you just recharge mentally, psychically, the idea being that maybe the house would help improve the governing of Britain. And then Churchill comes along, and Churchill is like, he's not going to not work. He lived for work, you know. So every weekend, this place is filled with guests. And I think my favorite story about Chequers is when one night, you know, he had these dinner parties for all these dignitaries and people from abroad and whatever. And there was a lot of booze and a lot of fun. And after one of these, Churchill, in the Great Hall at Chequers, he puts on the gramophone to play military music. And then he proceeds to begin doing a series of, very seriously for him, bayonet drills using his Mannlicher rifle with a bayonet attached at the end. But the thing is, he's wearing at this point his pale blue siren suit, which honestly makes him look like a pale blue Easter egg. You know, and the siren suit was this one-piece jumpsuit he had designed so that it could be pulled on at a moment's notice. So he's wearing that, but he's also wearing his gold dragon silk dressing gown. So here he is at Chequers with this rifle, pursuing these bayonet drills, you know, on the great hall of Chequers with all his guests gathered around, just in hysterics, you know, because here's the Prime Minister of England doing this thing in this purple, in this light blue jumpsuit, you know. It was tremendous.
I love the stories. I mean, I think you mentioned at one point, you said that Churchill never stopped being a boy.
I really feel like he never stopped being a boy. And that was part of his charm, part of what made his private secretaries tolerate that sort of intense work schedule.
So another thing you do throughout the book, you make these cuts to German leaders and their sort of their thought process during this. What were you hoping to convey with those cuts?
I felt it was very important to get the German input because it's important to know what they were thinking about as all this unfolded. Because the British, as you know, Luftwaffe began attacking, first attacking in sort of in a way that really sort of mystified the RAF. The British were having trouble understanding exactly what the Luftwaffe was trying to do. And I felt it was important then to understand what the Luftwaffe was trying to do, not just as a way of saying, okay, this is how they saw it. This is what they were actually, this is what Hermann Göring, head of the Luftwaffe, was actually trying to do at this point. But it was important also to, in terms of suspense, because if you know that they're planning, okay, the next giant raid on a city in England, and you know, of course, that the British don't know, or maybe have a sense that something's coming through their intelligence network. That's suspense. That's suspense. You want to find out what happens. You know, you know this is going to happen because the Germans are talking about it. The British don't, and you know that's one of the essences of crafting suspense.
And I also liked how you conveyed, I mean, sometimes like the surprise by the Germans about how defiant the British were. They just thought that they would just roll over.
Yep.
But they
yep.
never did. And they were trying to figure out how to spin this.
Yep.
Constantly.
The Germans really did think that the British would cave after this punishing aerial attack. They were stunned each time that Churchill would not give in. And Churchill did not give in. Churchill just grew more and more defiant, which in turn annoyed the Germans no end, especially Hitler. And it was ultimately his, you know, intransigent defiance that led Hitler to finally approve the bombing of central London, the bombing of civilian parts of cities, which Hitler previously had banned. He had explicitly said, you cannot, to Hermann Göring, you cannot bomb London, you cannot bomb central London, because Hitler did not want to so galvanize the British people and Churchill that they would not consider coming to the peace table. And Churchill was, you know, absolutely defiant. There's no way he was going to do that, right? And so one thing leads to another. And then Hitler finally authorizes attacks on London and massive attacks on London. You know, and now the strategy has changed to try to bring Churchill to the peace table by just sheer brutality. You know, and once again, it fails, but this is what was now happening.
And I mean, that's what eventually led to the Dresden bombings too. Like,
well, you know, tit for tat. I mean, right. You know, what preceded the September 7, 1940, the first deliberate raid on central London, the first, the night that is typically credited as being the start of the Blitz, what preceded that was a raid on August 24th, 1940. When bombs did fall on central London, nobody in London understood at that point, though, that this was an accident. This was from a, for lack of a better, I mean, I don't want to use the German terminology, a German bomber squadron had gotten lost and had dropped bombs on central London. This was a jarring, shocking thing, incredibly shocking, but it also gave Churchill moral justification now start bombing Berlin. That was what he decided, you know, that's what he wanted to do. He was waiting for moral justification to do that. Then comes, you know, September 7, 1940, and this tit-for-tat, you know, bombing raids, you know, Luftwaffe against British cities, RAF against German cities, you know, just continues to intensify it through the war until... Yes, the major campaigns against German cities like Dresden and so forth, that order of magnitude worse actually than what the Luftwaffe did to London.
And there's some other great stories from out of the German side that, I mean, that's what I love about this story, because there's so many different little stories in them. One of them, my favorite, I'm not going to talk about it too much, but it's like this renegade Nazi officer who goes rogue to try to broker a piece,
right.
Which is a lot of fun. I mean, what do you hope readers walk away with after they finish this book? Like, what do you want them to...
You know, my feeling is, my goal always with my books, first of all, is to invite readers to sink deeply into the past and experience it as if almost they were there, to try to have a visceral experience and maybe emerge from the book later feeling... like maybe they have a better appreciation of history, or even feeling somewhat changed. But I think also, I didn't intend this really at the beginning. I mean, I started this book about four and a half years ago. But really, I think what the book provides is, you know, kind of a refuge for people who I think it reminds people of what real leadership looked like at a time when that reminder is very handy, you know, because we don't have a lot of it right now. So I think that that's what the book, I think, could serve as a, could be valuable for people.
And one thing I took away from this, and I don't know if this was one of your intentions, but that maybe I'm capable of doing what they did too, right? Like going even into this, in the face of adversity like that, we can still continue to build a life.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, there is that, of course. I mean, the idea that, you know, I always think of Churchill as having taught people the art of being fearless. And I do feel that in some ways, not courage per se, but fearlessness of being able to venture into a situation that is, everything tells you is not the situation you should be venturing into, you know, and to venture in there without fear. I do feel that that can be, it's kind of a learned experience, you know, I mean, and you learn by observing others. And one of the things that Churchill was very, very good at, he understood the power of symbolic acts. He understood the power of visiting bombed out neighborhoods. He understood the power of, instead of cowering in a shelter when an air raid happened, he more often than not would climb to the nearest roof and watch that air raid, you know, and it became known, of course, that he did that. So, you know, the art of fearlessness can, I think, can be taught. And when you're in your darkest hours and you think about how these guys got through this whole thing and how they did it, yeah, I think that can help you too.
Well, Eric, is there some place people can go to learn more about the book and your work? You got a website?
Yeah, I have a website, ericlarsonbooks.com, and I've neglected it badly for the last 3 weeks of book touring, but that's going to change. So that's good. But more than anything, I just say, you know, read it.
Fantastic. We'll put a link to it on the show notes. Eric Larson, thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. I very much enjoyed it.
My guest today was Eric Larson. He's the author of the book, The Splendid and the Vile. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. You can find out more information about it, the book and his work at ericlarsonbooks.com. Also check out our show notes at aom.is/Larson, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM podcast. Check out our website at artofmanliness.com, where you can find our podcast archives, as well as thousands of articles we've written over the years about pretty much anything. We've got a whole series about Winston Churchill on there. Go check it out. And if you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate it if you take 1 minute to give us a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. It helps out a lot. If you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member if you think you get something out of it. And if you'd like to enjoy ad-free episodes of the AOM podcast, you can do so on Stitcher Premium. Head over to stitcherpremium.com, sign up, use code manliness at checkout. You get a free month trial of Stitcher Premium. Once you're signed up, download the Stitcher app on Android or iOS, and you start enjoying ad-free episodes of the AOM podcast. As always, thank you for your continued support. Until next time, this is Brett McKay, reminding you not only listen to the AOM podcast, but put what you've heard into action.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.